My name is Dr. Alan Peterson. Today's date is July 31st, 2013. Here today with us are Dr. Larry Bonchek, editor of the Journal of Lancaster General Health, president of the Edward Hand Medical Heritage Foundation. Dr. Zivanis is also with us. And Mrs. Ulrika Goldstein is the managing editor of the Journal of Lancaster General. Today we're here with Dr. Paul Ripple, retired ophthalmologist and Renaissance man. Paul, who is 91 years old today, grew up in Lancaster, graduated from McCaskey High School, Franklin and Marshall College, and the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. He interned at Lancaster General Hospital. His deep appreciation for history is evidenced by his membership in the Lancaster chapter of the Pennsylvania Society of Sons of the Revolution and in being a founding member of the Edward Hand Medical Foundation, among others. Let's start with your remembrance of the Edward Hand Foundation, Paul. Was this thought around 1983 in development, or what's your recollection of that?
I think so. I think it was about that time.
Okay.
We decided that we ought to have a foundation that remembers the medical history of Lancaster. We have a very, very rich history of medicine here in Lancaster, and we figured we should form a society to honor that tradition.
And when you say we?
Well, we had a lot of very good friends. Dr. John Attlee was very active. He was the second president after me. And we have a lot of doctors who were also interested in the history, the rich history of Lancaster medicine, which goes way back.
So you were the first president?
I was the first president.
Okay.
John Attlee was the second. And we had a very active board of directors. Charlie Smithgall was one of them, I remember.
Okay. And where did you meet in those beginning days?
Well, we met at the old Medical Society headquarters on
Walnut Street.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, who were the other members of the board at the time?
Well, I said, didn't mention the doctor.
You mentioned Dr. Attlee.
Dr. Attlee. Smithgall. We had
Henry Wentz.
Henry Wentz was very active. I should remember that. There was about four or five others. Okay. I don't remember for sure. But anyway, we had a very active board. We had regular meetings. I think we met almost once a month. Mm-hmm. And we had a little museum, which we got started behind the offices there.
And who actually do you think came up with the idea to try to save some of the history in Lancaster County? Was it sort of a group?
I think it was rumbling for many, many years.
Okay.
I think it was people were interested in the history. And,
okay.
And I know the Edward Hand, the trust, the Lancaster County Historical Trust was also interested in. We have a very old hospital, probably the second oldest hospital still standing today. Pennsylvania Hospital is the oldest in Philadelphia.
And where is that located in Lancaster?
West King Street.
Okay.
East King Street.
Okay.
Way out East King Street.
Okay. All right.
The old building is still there. It's in pretty bad shape, but it's still standing.
All right. And you were trying to purchase that at the time, is that correct?
We still have our eye on it, but we don't have the money. It would take several hundred thousand dollars to get it up to prime shape where it could be used as a medical museum. We proposed, the AMA does not have an official museum. We proposed to them several times that this would be an ideal spot for a medical museum. England has a big medical museum, the Hunter Museum, but they never took on the challenge. Okay. So it's still there; it hasn't been torn down yet. But it's hard to say how long it'll last.
So you started to collect some artifacts as you went along.
Oh yeah, I mean we were, yeah we remember going up to Allentown to get some stuff from a retired doctor. Anytime a doctor retired, we tried to get as much stuff as we could. Okay. So we had quite a collection.
And where were you storing these in the early days?
We were storing them in the basement of the Medical Society headquarters.
Okay.
And now we have a museum, a warehouse
Burl Industry?
Yeah, Burl Industry, yeah. Right.
On the New Holland Pike.
Yeah.
I understand Tom Beeman helped find space for you early on?
Yeah, I remember one time when we went to see the ball game and Beeman was there, and I went to Beeman and I said, you know, the group of us are very interested in the history of medicine in Lancaster. He said, I'm glad you are. Come to make an appointment to see me. So Henry Wentz and I, Henry Wentz had threw the first ball out, by the way. So Henry Wentz and I went to see Beeman, and he was very cooperative, and as you know, he furnished some space for us. We have a very nice little museum there now, thanks to him.
And what does the name Phil Zimmerman mean to you in those early days?
Name rings a bell, but I...
He's a contractor?
I think so, but I'm not sure.
He was a museum consultant.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I'm sorry. The Historical Society provided us with a consultant. I'd forgotten that was his name. Zimmerman, yeah.
Yeah.
He was very active. Was at the meetings. I don't know if he's still employed or not.
Yeah. He's independent contractor.
Really? Okay.
And I understand you started out with about 1,500 artifacts to begin with?
About, yeah. Okay. So if we first stored them in the basement of my office.
Oh.
I had shelves down there, and pretty soon, it didn't take long before they were loaded with artifacts.
Oh, that's great.
And then I think, Paul, remember after that got filled up, Tom Beeman gave you some space on Marshall Avenue before we went out to the Burl Building.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Anything else that you...
Mrs. Kendrick Eshelman was very active. Cataloging all this stuff.
Mrs. Kendrick Eshelman.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything else that you can think about for the early beginnings of the Hand Foundation that stick out in your mind?
I can't think of any.
How about Sam Houck?
Oh, Sam Houck was very... I should mention that. Oh, another one was...
Mortimer.
What?
Mortimer. The fellow that ran the Allied Supply.
He was very active. He would appraise material. When people donated, he would make the appraisals.
Oh. And, very good.
Sam Houck was very active, too.
Okay. Do you have any significant stories, Paul, concerning some of the past well-known Lancaster physicians?
You said something about Dave Simons. The most interesting guy I ever met in my life.
Tell us about Dave.
Well, Dave Simons and I interned together at the General Hospital.
What year was that, Paul?
1947.
Okay.
And if the EKG machine broke at the hospital, Dave Simons could fix it. He was a genius.
Okay.
And one of the funniest stories there was one time... We were having breakfast, and Ray Hall, who ran the finances of the hospital, ran the whole hospital. As a matter of fact, he came storming in there and said, Dave Simons, you got 45 big cartons blocking the dock in the back of the hospital where they bring stuff in. Nobody can't use it because you have 45 boxes. So Dave says, oh, I was a low bidder. He went to a war surplus sale in Philadelphia and bought 40 big boxes, and I said, Dave, what's in the boxes? Well, come with me. So we went out and opened up the big carton and brought out a little box and opened it up, and in there were about 500 leather washers. And he bought a million leather washers.
And what was that for?
Well, during the war, if they wanted to put up a wire communications, they would get a big nail and put the leather washer in. Then they put a porcelain thing to tie the wire around. Uh-huh. And then put another leather washer in, and then hammer it in, and the leather washers kept the porcelain thing from being broken. So now he had a million, and when he moved out to Wright-Patterson Field, I went out there about a year later when I was on a project, and I was assigned to Wright-Patterson for a month, and I stayed at his home. And when he got there at night, I got out of the car and walked into the kitchen and went like this and looked down. Here are these damn leather washers. He had surfaced his driveway with a million leather washers.
So it had nothing to do with the hospital.
Nothing to do with the hospital.
Okay. Is Dave Simon still living?
No, no. He died about a year ago. He at one time was the highest man in space.
Well,
he went up. And the idea, he was supposed to stay up for about 2 or 3 hours at over 100,000 feet. But due to storms, he had to stay up for 13 hours. He had no business going up in that damn balloon because he had episodes of auricular fibrillation. Tachycardia. Auricular tachycardia. Episode. He shouldn't have ever been up in that damn garage, but he was crazy. And he fell in love with the guy who made the balloon for him. He fell in love with his wife, and he married her. And that didn't last very long. And then he married a third wife, and he visited me in Lancaster here about 3 or 4 years ago and said, you know, I found out why I had lost my first two wives. It was all my fault. And I almost blurted out, well, Dave, I could have told you that. I could have told you that.
I actually Googled Dave Simons. He was unbelievably important in our early space program.
And here's something that very few people knew about. Dave Simon was a student at the School of Aviation Medicine at Randolph Field when I was an instructor. And he was living very close to me. Anyway, and every now and then he'd get secret orders from Los Alamos that even the commander of our base had no idea what it was, but he'd be gone for 2 or 3 days, and I was the only one that knew what he was gone for. Mm-hmm. When he went out to Los Alamos, there was a big V-2 rocket. Werner von Braun was there, too. Mm-hmm. He was the guy that was conducting the rocket part. And Dave Simons got a ladder, put it up against the V-2 rocket, climbed up the ladder, opened up the hatch, and put in an anesthetized monkey inside the cone of the rocket, which he designed. Dave Simons designed it, and it attached to respirations and heart beating and blood pressure and everything else.
Right.
Then he would shut the thing, climb down the ladder, and get behind the bunker, vroom, up it went. So he sent the first animals into space to check cosmic radiation and whether there was any adverse effects to animals. And not many people know about that because it was high secret, very high secret when they were doing it. So that was the most amazing thing. And then when he retired from the service, he and a lady wrote a book about pressure points. And he was a real crazy advocate of pressure points. It's a little like acupuncture.
Yeah.
And it does work. I know a couple of his pressure points. But he wrote a book about that. He and his lady doctor.
Yeah, some of the information that I saw, they mentioned, of course, von Braun, which I remember, you know, the name growing up.
I met Werner von Braun.
Okay.
He was out there.
And supposedly, David designed the closed capsule for the Redstone rocket.
Yeah.
That was one of the
things. Yeah, he was a genius. He really was.
He was crazy,
but he was a genius.
He was an intern here?
He was an intern.
I interned with him.
Right.
He and I interned together. His father was a very famous family doctor in Marietta. And his father lived in that big mansion in Marietta.
So he was from Lancaster.
Oh, yeah, he's from Lancaster. He had a couple other Dr. Simons.
Do you remember his father's name, first name?
No, I don't remember.
Okay. Supposedly, he set the stage for NASA's exploration into space in the 1960s.
That's exactly. He was a space pioneer.
Yeah.
He was a real genuine space pioneer.
Do you remember any of the other interns that were here at the time?
Well, he was by far the most famous one.
Okay. How many interns were there in your year? Do you remember?
I think we had six.
Okay.
Six interns. And if you left the elevator on the second floor of the employees' parking lot. My picture's there on the wall.
All right.
Switching them. When I was an intern, I was in charge of the emergency room. The intern was in charge of the ER and one nurse. So one intern and one nurse ran the emergency room.
Very good.
Because family doctors did a lot of house calls in those days.
Right. That's right.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm.
So, do you know anybody by the name of Theo Apple? Dr. Apple.
Oh, Jim. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Sure do. I had some interesting stories in the gym.
Tell us some of those.
Well, I think one of the most interesting was when he came home after being elected president of the AMA, the whole medical society was hiding in his home, and they parked their cars way away. So I can still remember looking out the window and seeing Jim driving up, get out of the car, picks up his suitcases, and opens the door. And the whole medical staff there for two hours, drinking and celebrating Jim Apple's.
Quite a celebration.
Celebration. Another story with Jim. One time Jim called me and said, I want you and the ambulance driver to come to this address. It was about midnight. So anyway, I woke up the ambulance driver. I said, we're supposed to come to this address. And it was down in the south section, in a pretty tough section of Lancaster. And Jim was on the sidewalk. He said, bring the stretcher upstairs. So we brought the stretcher upstairs. And here was a guy all dressed in his jacket and coat and tie, dead on the floor. And this girl looking around the corner. It's pretty obvious.
Didn't need an ambulance.
Died in having sex.
Oh.
So now we carried him down the steps, put him in the elevator. The next morning on the front page, prominent citizen found pronounced dead in the emergency room at the General Hospital. And only his girlfriend, Jim Apple, and I and the ambulance driver know this true story.
Well, now the world knows.
Jim says, this is a secret. You don't talk.
Well, the world doesn't know because he didn't mention the name.
I didn't mention the guy's name. But he was a pretty prominent citizen.
Okay.
It would have been a great story.
Sure.
Well, it wasn't Nelson Rockefeller.
No, very similar.
Now, when I started my residency here, there were stories about the Pontiuses and the Attlees. I was wondering if you could tell us some of the stories that you remember, for example, of the early Attlees.
Well, I mean, I remember there were five generations of Attlees.
Physicians.
And I was a pallbearer at John Attlee's funeral at St. James. And I remember he had a son who was an anesthesiologist out in St. Louis or somewhere. So that was, he was the fifth Dr. Attlee. And I got talking to him, and I said, now you understand you have a son. I said, he's going to be a doctor, and he said, only if he wants to be. So that was John Attlee's son. And
any of the other Attlees? There are any other Attlee stories that you remember?
That's about the best one I have.
Okay. And how about the Pontiuses? Saul and John, right?
Well, yeah. Well, Saul was a very famous guy. And I can remember in the operating room, when Saul Pontius was done operating, somebody brought him a chicken sandwich.
Into the operating room?
No, well, in the doctor's dressing room.
All right.
Then there was a sofa in there that he slept on. So Dr. Saul Pontius always slept for about 15 or 20 minutes after surgery, after he ate his chicken sandwich, same routine every day. And John Pontius was a very good friend of mine. We played golf together a lot. Okay. He had a nice place down on the bay.
You did a lot of sailing with him?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, not with him. I did a lot of sailing.
Right.
My second most favorite vacation next to skiing.
Great. We'll get into that in a little bit.
All right.
How about Joe Appleyard?
Joe Appleyard, he was a character. He was, and whatever Joe Appleyard said was was the law. I mean, he ran the staff, and I mentioned the guy's name who ran the finances of the hospital.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, Appleyard ran the staff of the hospital. He was an absolute ruler. Another story I know, he died of cancer, and he went out to Mayo. When he went out to Mayo, he bought a one-way ticket. That was a story.
Did he make it back?
I don't think he did.
Oh, okay.
So I think it worked.
Guess he knew.
And
well, maybe he didn't want to spend the money to come back.
I guess that was it. He was.
Anything else about Joe?
Was he a physician? I mean.
He ran the answering service, the medical profession. He was the officer.
Medical
he
society.
Was in charge of that. And I was on his committee for a couple of years.
Paul, I think he was among the first urologists in Lancaster.
I think you're right.
Yeah. And his daughter married John Pontius.
Yeah, well, that's right. And another interesting thing, during the war, if any female got gonorrhea, she got impounded in the hospital. Joe Appleyard said to the hospital, she said, well, I want a hearing, no hearing. I mean, he was the absolute ruler. When he told some gal that she had gonorrhea and was going to stay in the hospital, see, she was cured. Because Lancaster had a reputation as being a very good
public
Liberty Town sailors, particularly okay. Coming up from Bainbridge,
right.
and quite a few of them got gonorrhea here. Appleyard cleared it up pretty good by
quarantining
the girls until they were cured. No hearings, just boom, off you go.
Do you know how long he kept them in the hospital?
Until they got cured.
Okay.
Delivered.
Did they have penicillin?
That was at Rossmere is where
well,
it was.
After the war, they would have had
yeah.
penicillin. Rossmere was the old TB hospital.
What
now,
do you
now.
Remember about Rossmere?
That's about all I can remember. It was a TB hospital for many years, and then it was a gonorrhea hospital.
do you remember when it closed down?
No, I don't.
I think it was around 1957.
I think, yeah. It was after the war.
How about some of the surgeons that I remember? I'm sure you do also. John Farmer?
Oh, John Farmer. Oh, well, he and my wife are related.
Oh.
The Farmers. Dick, I still see Dick Farmer. I still see him a lot. He plays a lot of bridge.
Is that one of the sons?
And what?
No, a son?
Brother.
Brother.
John Farmer.
Okay.
And I remember...
John
well,
Farmer
of course, John Farmer was in the South Pacific, and there's a book that's written about John Farmer.
World War II?
World War II.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was Rufus Fulton's father-in-law.
Right.
Judy Fulton's his daughter.
That's correct. And I just remember one thing. Clarence Farmer was his father. And Clarence Farmer was a very famous doctor during the war. He did a lot of operations because there were a shortage of doctors during the war.
Okay.
And one time, John Farmer was helping his father. The two of them were operating together, Clarence and John. And all of a sudden, Clarence Farmer stepped back, put his head back, stretched. And John Farmer had a very short fuse. His father had a long fuse, but John had a very short fuse, so... John Harheim, father, watch what you're doing. You're not helping me. He said, son, I just have a little kink in my back. I just still remember.
Oh, that's great.
This Clarence Farmer was just the opposite. He had a very long view. But the book of Something of Valor is about that his son wrote about John Farmer and his service in the South Pacific.
What was the name of it again?
Said Something of Valor, you said?
Something
of Valor. Okay. Instead of Something of Value.
Something okay. of Valor.
Something of Valor. Valor.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he was in the South Pacific during the war. He was on two different islands, I think.
Okay. Paul Davidson.
Well, Paul Davidson was a pretty straight-laced guy. He was a very active teacher. I think he taught
I remember more, him well.
I think he taught more interns had it than I had some about surgery. He was a very wonderful guy. But there's nothing wrong, nothing, no character stories about him.
When I came here, he was the last of that generation.
Oh, yeah?
Still practicing.
Good.
Yeah. I operated on his brother.
Yeah.
I'll share one interesting story with Paul that I had when I was a resident here.
Yeah.
We were up in the OR, and he would allow the residents to close up the incisions at the end. So I was closing it up, and he was trying to hold the tissues together so that I could get a good stitch. Well, I was going along, and he and I were talking, and I got his finger with a needle.
Oh,
and so, of course, he you know, went back a little bit. I apologized profusely, and after that, he would call me Flashing Fingers Peterson.
Okay. Well, the last operation I did was a muscle operation, and I stuck the nurse with a needle.
Yeah.
And, of course, the first thing she thought about was AIDS.
Yeah.
And I said, this is a kid. He's only 7 years old. I said, he don't have AIDS. But she was very upset.
Charlie Bear, family physician, Quarryville. You remember Charlie?
Oh, yeah.
Any stories about Charlie at all?
Can't think of any offhand.
He probably sent you quite a few patients the day, I would think.
Yeah, he delivered a lot of babies.
Yep.
I think he probably delivered as many babies as any other doctor. And lots of times you wouldn't bother waking me up, but if there was a breach, he always woke me up and says, hey, Dr. Ribble, get up there, I got a breach for you.
Was he one of the interns with you? Or?
No, he was practicing.
Okay.
Charlie, yeah.
You were just on call in the
Charlie
hospital?
Charlie Bear was a groundhog, too.
Okay.
That was a groundhog.
You were?
I am a groundhog.
Okay. Very good. Very good. The Espenshades, senior and junior.
The Espenshades were family doctors, our doctors, for two generations. Okay. I remember Howard was a very good friend of my father, and they were very, very good friends. They went on vacations together. And then John lives in Florida now. Mm-hmm. I introduced him to his wife one time. We were skiing over in Europe, and we were coming home in an airplane, and John Espenshade was seated along the aisle and squeezed in by two very heavy-set ladies. And I said, John, three seats back is a beautiful girl all by herself on sprawled over three seats. I said, well, where is he? Where is she? And in 15 or 20 minutes, they were necking, and they got married. They got married. So I introduced you to
them. Oh, that's a great story.
That is.
That's a great story.
And every now and then he calls from Florida. The girl he married was a Swede.
Elzebeth.
Yeah, Elzebeth. And they used to go there in the summertime and spend about a month in Sweden with her friends and family. Mm-hmm. And she could speak five languages. She was an airline hostess. She was on her deadheading back when she was in that seat. And like I said, I introduced them, more or less.
Anything you remember about Howard in particular?
Who?
Espenshade, Howard. Father?
Oh, the father. Like I said, he was our family doctor.
He was an internist, correct?
Yeah, he was an internist.
Okay.
And he started the children's hospital up a
rheumatic fever.
Yeah.
That was the rheumatic fever hospital.
That's right.
Right next door to our hospital.
Okay.
And Howard was the first cardiologist. He was an internist.
That's
but
true.
He then devoted most of the rest of
yeah,
his
right.
professional life to right. cardiology.
And wasn't John in charge of the educational program?
Yes.
Yes, he was, yeah.
For a while.
He became John Espenshade, his son, became the director of medical education in 1968 and served in that capacity for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Howard Yeckert.
Well, he's an old friend of mine. We met through the Sir Thomas Club, and today's my birthday, and Howie always calls me
Yeckert.
And sings happy birthday over the phone without saying who he is. I haven't got the phone call yet, but it'll be coming. But he and I, we used to fly together. He was quite a pilot, and his wife was even more famous as a pilot, Jessie. Jessie Yeckert taught student pilots during the war, because F&M had a program for pre-flight, and those guys would go out and take lessons in flight from Jessie Yeckert. Because Jessie Yeckert's father is probably the most famous early pilot of Lancaster.
Hmm.
Old Jessie Yeckert, the old Lancaster airport on Manapike.
Well, if you talk to him today, tell him Al Peterson says hi.
Okay.
He took my wisdom teeth out when I was a resident.
Okay. Yeah. Well, he's unfortunately in a wheelchair now, like I am.
Oh. And.
But he's fortunately. Jessie Eckhart's wonderful wife. He's very lucky. And, of course, the sons are very famous oral surgeon. I mean, what? Michael Eckhart just pulled my teeth out about a month ago. And the other son runs a investment business outside of Philadelphia. So both of the sons are doing very well.
And another name you know very well, Dr. Henry Wentz.
Oh, Henry. Well, Henry is the reason I interned at the General Hospital.
That's what he told me.
Yeah, but I was debating whether to intern at the University Hospital in Philadelphia. And Henry says, if you're going to practice in Lancaster, you better intern in Lancaster. You got to get a head start. So he talked me into being an intern here at the General Hospital, which was a great experience. I think I learned more from the nurses here at the General when I was an intern. I mean, when I get an admission, like a woman's medical ward, I go in the first, they ask the nurse, now, what's this patient having? What should I do? And they taught me more practical medicine than the doctors.
Great. I understand that Henry's parents and your parents were friends?
Oh, yeah, the Wentzes were very good friends. Well, I can remember when the Wentzes decided to go down to Ocean City for a month in July, my parents did too. And I remember going with Henry Wentz to the beach, and he's 1 year older than I was, and we always played his games. So whenever we went to the beach to play games and stuff, go swimming, then they decided to go to Mount Gretna 1 year, so we went to Mount Gretna for 1 year. So our parents did everything that the Wentzes did. So Henry and I are very good friends from way back. The first time I was allowed to have the family car to take a date at the Wentz's home. Henry had a party. Oh, Henry went to Duke, and there was football. They were undefeated, unscored on 1 year, and they had a party at his home. And I took my first date, the first time I was allowed to have the car to take a date.
A memorable occasion.
Yeah.
You did a lot of fishing down at the bay with him, I understand.
Yeah. Yeah, we used to go out. It was interesting. We'd go out on Bowers' Beach, and we'd get way out. And we get way out there beyond most of the other fishing boats, and the captain put up a little flag. Well, that flag was a note to the rum runners who was doing prohibition. And this rum runner would pull up alongside our fishing boat. And the guy said, how many cases do you want? So both Henry Wentz's father and my father both bought a couple cases of panther piss. That's the only thing that was on the bottle, was a big black panther pissing into a bottle. And everybody thought, isn't it wonderful these fathers taking their sons fishing? We were an excuse to go down and get a couple cases of whiskey.
That's great.
True story.
Henry tells me that one of those occasions, you apparently wore him out so much that he actually slept through the fishing part of the day.
Oh, really? I don't remember that. But like I said, when we both had younger brothers who were a pain in the neck most of the time.
He remembers one of the things that really struck him about you were the portrayals that you've done in Lancaster history, Lancaster County.
Well, I did James Buchanan at his 100th, or 100th anniversary at his home.
Okay.
And I remember I was on the front porch, and some guy hollered out, he said, "Why were you kicked out of law school?" I didn't know that. Evidently, James Buchanan was a big party boy.
Oh.
And he got kicked out of law school because he was too big a party boy, but he was allowed to get back in. So then I portrayed Ellicott.
Signer of the Decorate.
But I did the 100th anniversary of Ellicott's visit. Uh-huh. The two guys that did that tour out west.
Lewis and Clark.
Mm-hmm. Well, the guy that, yeah, so the guy that portrayed Lewis was the secretary of the president, Jefferson, at the time. Right. And he was given the job of organizing an expedition out west. And the first thing that President Jefferson said, "You got to go to see the best choreographer, map maker in the United States, and he lives in Lancaster, Pennsylvania." So he sent Lewis to see Ellicott, and he spent a month there learning navigation over land from Ellicott.
In Lancaster?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Ellicott was a very interesting guy. Laid out the borderline between the Spanish Florida and the United States. Mm-hmm. Spain owned part of Florida. Mm-hmm. And Ellicott was we were in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. We were driving in a bus on a sightseeing tour. He said, "Now this is Ellicott Hill." I said, "Ellicott? You mean Ellicott, the guy?" "Yeah, okay." He did a surveying of the border and found out that in Baton Rouge, where the governor of Spain was living, that was in the United States. So he had to go to the governor of Florida and say, "Pardon me, sir, but you're living in the United States. You got to go to New Orleans." So the guy evidently reluctantly gave in, but Ellicott did that. Another thing he did was, when he did the border of Pennsylvania, found out that the borderline,
Mason-Dixon line?
Mason-Dixon was 5 miles off. And the other thing he did, when he got up to Lake Erie, he found out that Pennsylvania did not touch Lake Erie. So he arranged to buy a big hunk of land where Buffalo is so that Pennsylvania would have access to Lake Erie.
Fascinating.
That was Ellicott.
Now, you said he surveyed Florida, but then you said Baton Rouge. So did you mean Louisiana?
Yeah, Louisiana.
That he surveyed. Not
and
Florida.
Okay. He almost died of malaria, I know, mm-hmm. down there. So. Mm-hmm.
So how did you get into these portrayal characters?
Because I was a character.
Did you
I don't know.
Did you just raise your hand and say, "I'd like to do this," or did somebody say, "I think you're the man for the job"?
I'm not exactly sure. But
okay. Very good.
And, when they decided to, when Goldie Hoffman and Mayor Monahan tore down half of Lancaster, the second block of North Queen Street, nobody complained about tearing down the old YMCA or Grand Theater or the Colonial Theater.
All historical buildings.
But when he decided to tear down the Ellicott House, a bunch of us said, "No way. You're not going to." It was a 10-year battle, but we won. We saved.
That's great.
We saved the Ellicott house. Mm-hmm. It's still there. And the garage has a big hunk taken out of it. The parking garage.
I drive by it all the time.
But that was a battle. It lasted 10 years. And it was nip and tuck.
Isn't that where the historical...
Yeah, that's where the Historic Preservation Trust. I was the second president of the Historic Preservation Trust.
And that's in the Ellicott House.
In the Ellicott House, right.
Can you tell us more about that experience? Your involvement with the Historical Preservation Trust?
Well, like I said, it was... trying to think of the guy who... The first president, I can't think of his name now, but he... Very good friend of mine, needless to say it, and I was second president. John Unks was third president. But I can remember when we went down to Philadelphia to check with HUD in Philadelphia, I said, we haven't heard much about the Ellicott House. They opened it for us, and it was scheduled for demolition next week. We didn't know, nobody told us. The Chamber of Commerce was after us. We were obstructing progress in Lancaster. So the Chamber of Commerce, we went to one of their meetings and they booed us when we walked in. And they, even president of F&M came into my office and tried to talk me out of trying to save the Ellicott House. And when it was all over, he came in and he apologized. He says, I'm sorry. He said, you were right. I was wrong.
That's great.
So,
too bad you didn't save the Hotel Brunswick, too.
Yeah, that's right. That was a great old hotel. That was a beautiful with big marble pillars. And used to have tea dances in there.
Can you think of any other physicians that were on the staff, either in your earlier days or later days, that you'd like to mention?
How about Sam Houck? Can you comment about
Sam? Sam Houck was a great guy with preservation, too. He and I used to... When a doctor died somewhere, we went to try to get as much of the
artifacts
as we could. And Sam Houck and I went together, the two of us, to about three or four different wives of husbands that just died. And we did get quite a bit of material. It's amazing how much stuff we got. But Sam Houck was always very active in that particular phase.
Do you remember, Paul, when the residency program was started and the controversies that related to that issue at the time?
I know very little about that. We had no ophthalmology residents.
As you were growing up in Lancaster, what do you recollect about the history in the area from your family as you were growing up through your internship and even after that?
Oh, boy. I don't know which end to start.
Wherever you want to start, Paul.
Well, I remember I was born in St. Joseph's Hospital, right on the corner, when it was a big castle. Nothing was left of that anymore. But in those days, you stayed in the hospital a whole week. Mm-hmm. But I remember staying in the hospital a whole week, and I remember the Catholic Sisters... They ran the hospital. Sure. Catholic Sisters ran St. Joseph Hospital. And then we lived on Wheatland Avenue, 1028 Wheatland Avenue. And I used to walk to school after breakfast, come home for lunch, walked home for lunch, walked back to school again, and then walked home. There were no fat kids in our class. We walked up, but I walked about 3 miles every day. But I went to West End Township School. And then when I graduated from there, I had my choice of going to Manham Township or McCaskey. But before I went to McCaskey, I spent 6 months in the Old Boys High School. So I went to we were the last guys to go to Old Boys High School.
That was in Lancaster.
It's still there. The building's still there. Old Boys High School. It's now. And then...
What street is that located on, do you know?
It's on Orange... West Queen.
Okay.
I mean, West King.
Okay.
And it's still there. And then the girls went to... They had their own high school one block away, Stevens, and so the girls went to one school, we went to another school. And then when we went into McCaskey in January of 38, our High Y Club carried library books from the old boys' high school at Stevens Trade into the new high school. Remember, we had these army trucks, and we would carry these boxes, carry the books in cardboard boxes, and then we'd sit in the back of the truck and freeze. It was January, and then we had to carry the books up the steps in the library, and McCaskey was on the second floor. It took about a week to transfer all the books from Stevens High and from the old boys' high school.
But it was free labor.
Free labor, yeah, free labor for the High White Club. So the girls' reserves had an organization in high school. We had the High White Clubs. And we'd have roller skating parties.
How did you get involved with F&M?
Well, I said, I want to go to Dartmouth. And my father said, if I'm going to have to pay your way through medical school, you got to go to F&M. So I remember he gave me a check for $350, and I rode over on my bicycle to Dean Baumberger's home, and I said, I want to be enrolled at F&M in pre-med. Here's the check. You're in. I drove back on my bicycle.
That's great. What do you remember about the time that you spent at F&M?
Well, it was just before the war, so we still had Hell Week, and we had a pajama parade. The pajama parade was every fall. All the freshmen had to wear pajamas and then go through a panel brigade and then walk downtown in a parade to a movie theater, and these girls would line the sidewalk to get kissed. So it was as freshmen, we had to kiss all the girls going down the street, and the girls were all lined up.
A tough job.
I got herpes.
You got herpes?
Yeah.
Oh, Paul. Some other memories about F&M.
Well, like I said, we had Hell Week because there were still, it was just before the war, I feel sorry for. Oh, the other thing, at a football game, all the freshmen had to sit at F&M in one section, compulsory attendance. And then they would take our shoes off and take them down in a carriage to the other side down below the goalpost. And we were lined up at this goalpost, and they blew a whistle, and we had to run down across the field and find our shoes. And then we had something called Robot, where we would build bonfires in the street. And all that stuff's gone now.
Right.
The kids today are missing out on.
I understand you managed the football team?
Yeah. I got a letter. I was a water boy at the Dartmouth game. When F&M beat Dartmouth, I was a water boy at that game. And I'm one of the few people who know how F&M won that game. Wait, Dartmouth didn't have their first ring, their quarterback in uniform. They didn't want to let him get hurt playing with his dumb little school from Pennsylvania. But at halftime, F&M was 2 touchdowns ahead. So in the second half, it was a different ball game. And Dartmouth was marching down the field. It was pretty obvious that F&M's football team, which was, they got, most of the guys played offense and defense, they were literally getting worn down, worn out. And with about 2 or 3 minutes to go, and Dartmouth was obviously going to win the game. And all of a sudden, Dick Vaughn, was a friend of mine on the football team, laid on the field. And I'm sure everybody in that crowd knew damn well that he was faking an injury so he could get some time out for it. And when I went up with my bucket of water to his water boy, he winked at me. So I knew for a fact that he was faking an injury to get a timeout.
Did it help them win or not?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, yeah, that's how we won.
All right.
That's how we won.
That's great.
We hung on there just long enough to win.
That's great. Do you remember any of your old professors at FNF?
Oh, yeah. It was, yeah, I remember quite a few FNM professors.
Anybody stand out?
Well, about our biology teacher, Foster. Boys, chewed a cigar the whole time he was teaching class. He had a cigar. It was never lit the damn thing, but he was chewing on it all the time. And chemistry professor. Yeah, I remember.
And how did you end up choosing your medical school?
Well, that was interesting. I went with Dr. Espinche down to Temple, where he went to medical school, and he got me into Temple Medical School.
This was Howard.
Yeah,
okay.
Howard.
Okay.
And then I thought, you know, I think I'll give a go at University of Pennsylvania. So I went down to the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, and Dr. I should remember the dean of the medical school was a very austere guy, Pepper. He was Dr. Pepper. They said the best way to get into medical practice in Philadelphia is to get into or out of the pelvis of a pepper. and so I'm down there, and Dr. Pepper, very austere guy, and looking at me, and I said, "Oh, I mean," he said, "I got a letter here from FNM saying you're a good student." He said, "That's good enough for me. What do you want to talk about?"
Wow.
Just like that. A letter from FNM.
Wow.
Got you right into University of Pennsylvania. There were three of us that went there, and about 10 went to Jefferson.
Great. How did you get interested in ophthalmology?
I think I was interested in ophthalmology way back, and then when I was an intern here, I used to help Dr. Fulton do cataracts and stuff.
Fulton?
Yeah, Harry Fulton. He was the oldest ophthalmologist in the country at one time, and he got his 100th certificate from the Medical Society, which I helped to present to him. And Harry Fulton used to smoke cigarettes all day long. And we would have, when he was 100 years old, he was chewing tobacco, and I said, "Harry, how come you're not smoking anymore?" He said, "I can't hold the cigarettes." So he's chewing tobacco. And he lived to be 102.
Oh, wow.
And I used to help him with a lot of his surgery, and I can remember they'd bring the patient in their bed. They wouldn't lift him up and back, because it was considered a little too fragile. So they always operated in the bed. And that was, and I said, "Harry," I said, "you know, when you're operating with the head of the foot, you have to sort of lean over that. Well, put the patient in backwards and put the patient in with their head at the back end." Good idea. So from there on, cataract patients were brought in with the backwards in the bed. And then after the cataract was out, they hooked sandbags. They weren't allowed to move. Mm-hmm. So.
How long was the specialty in those days, your training for ophthalmology?
Well, I got very fortunate. I got credit when I was in the medical or in the School of Aviation Medicine in Randolph Field. My immediate commander was a member of the board of the academy. And I got credit, 1 year's credit toward my accreditation from my Army experience. So I only had to take a 2-year residency instead of a 3-year residency. And I did that in St. Louis, Washington University. And
you've been involved with many groups such as the Lancaster City and County Medical Society, the Historic Preservation Trust, Longs Park Amphitheater Foundation, Lancaster Museum of Art, Sertoma Club, and many others. Do you have any memorable stories you'd like to share about some of these groups?
Yeah, you're right. I was pretty active. I was, as I said, second president of the Preservation Trust. I was president of the Medical Society, president of the Sir Thomas Club.
Anything stand out among them at all?
I guess just like being involved, I guess, in activities. I was on the original board of the Art Museum, Lancaster County. We met at F&M for 10 years on the top floor of Diagnosium. And I was vice president. It was time for me to be president. I turned it over to Woolworth, Mrs. Woolworth. It was the best thing I ever did for the Arts Association was his turn to not accept being president. I was too busy to really be a good president. And so everybody accepted that.
You've been an artist. I still see your caricatures of the specialists in the LGH staff lounge, for example.
I just gave those to the Medical Society Journal. I said, if you're looking for stuff to put in the journal, I gave them all the caricatures. So you may start seeing them again.
You've skied and traveled all over the world?
Yeah, I did. I traveled everywhere except Australia. Never got to Australia.
We mentioned you managing the F&M football team.
Yeah.
You've been happy?
I got a letter for that.
Okay. Manager. How long did you manage them?
I was there only 3 years. Because of the war, we got no summer vacation. And the same thing in medical school. So I graduated from college and medical school each in 3 years instead of four. But then we had to pay it back in the service. And I was very lucky to get a good position at Randolph Field in the School of Aviation Medicine. That's where Dave Simons was a student there. I was an instructor, and he was a student at Randolph Field School of Aviation Medicine.
You sort of followed each other a bit then.
We did. And then I had a project where I stayed with him in Wright-Patterson Field when he was running that big centrifuge.
I would be neglectful if I didn't mention that you've been happily married for over 65 years.
Right.
With 3 children.
Right.
6 grandchildren.
Yeah.
6 great-grandchildren.
Right.
And, again, you spent decades practicing ophthalmology. We didn't really touch much on that today because Dr. John Bowman and you have a nice article in the Edward Hand Foundation archives.
So it's pretty much in there.
Is there anything you want to mention about your ophthalmology practice or your ophthalmology days?
Not particularly. I mean,
how long did you practice in Lancaster?
About 50 years.
Did you practice anywhere else?
No. As soon as I left my training in St. Louis at Washington University, I figured, every time we had a vacation, we had to go to Lancaster. Because that's where our families were. So I said, why don't we live in Lancaster, and then when we get a vacation, we can go somewhere else. That was the main reason, and it worked. So now we're living in Lancaster, and if now we take a vacation, we can go someplace else.
Did anyone else join your practice?
Oh, yeah, Dr. Howe. When I went to Africa for a month on a hunting safari. And 1 week before the hunting safari, I did surgery at the Mennonite Hospital in Shirati, where Dr. Hausman was the head doctor. And I taught Dr. I took a set of instruments from the, who donated them, but I took those over there, and the two of us did about 50 cataracts in 1 week. And I taught him how to do them, and he did about 100 cataracts in Africa before he went to Will's Hospital, where he did more cataracts than his instructors. So Dr. Hausman, And he was also a pilot. Hal Hausman was a pilot. And I remember one time when he said, "You want to see the Lits air fireworks?" I said, "Okay." He says, "Okay, I'll see you at the airport." The airport. Next thing I knew, we were flying over the fireworks, the Lits fireworks, looking down. And there was two other airplanes doing the same thing. And he said, I'll watch the airplanes. You watch the fireworks." It was Harold Hausman. And then after he took his eye training, he went to Africa again and did some work. So he was a real missionary doctor, donated lots of time to the hospital. And then I got, I sold my practice to Dr. Corallo, Dr. Corallo. Mm-hmm. And now she just, the office is now for sale, or for rent. For sale, I think, now. Okay. It's a good location, but
right. It's
pretty small. I thought the hospital would buy it, because they bought other properties along across from the hospital.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us, Paul, in the next few minutes?
Wait, I think we covered it. I can't think of anything we missed.
It took you 91 years to get this far, Paul.
Would you comment about Ian Hodge and Ward O'Donnell back in those days?
Ian Hodge.
Well, he was a great golfer. And I remember he had a home, and he had a driving range in his basement. It wasn't a range, but it was a setup you could put on the screen pictures of very famous golf holes, and then you'd have a different picture and drive golf balls into a target and roll out. So, and then he used one of my caricatures on the front page. He was president of the Urological Association, mm-hmm. and he used one of my caricature of the urologist on the front page of the Journal of Urology.
Great. That's great. How about Dr. Ward O'Donnell, pathologist?
Well, he and I were members of the Tuckwarm Club for many years together. So he was a good party guy.
Is there any group?
Yeah, we used to entertain the interns. Ward O'Donnell and I would entertain the interns at the Hamilton Club.
Is there any group that you haven't been a member of, Paul?
Well, I was a church council for a Sunday school teacher.
How about Mortimer Kadushian? Can you comment about him?
Mortimer Kadushian.
He was very much involved in the old early days with the Edwardian Medical Heritage Foundation.
Yeah, he did. He did some of the appraisals.
Of the artifacts?
Yeah, the artifacts. Yeah.
Okay. I would particularly like to hear about your relatives in the Revolutionary War. Do you know of any involvement of them with Edward Hand, for example?
No. He was my association is with a silversmith from Switzerland who was a colonel in the Revolutionary War. And he was a silversmith. I had some of his silver.
Wow.
And Esmondshade had some of his silver.
Wow. But as far as you know, there was no connection between Edward
and
Hand.
His first wife died, and he married a bowman. And the bowmans were, my lineage, I can trace it right back to him. I can't think of his name now.
Any relation to John Bauman, the ophthalmologist?
I don't think so.
Okay. And
she's going to go through this too.
Maybe someday.
Oh, no, not today?
Paul, I want to thank you very much for sharing a few tidbits of your life with us.
Okay.
All 91 years.
Right.
And I want to wish you a very happy birthday.
Thank you.
And if you have a moment, we have something coming through that door. I think she just went out to get it.
Okay.
So if you'll just wait a moment. And if you'd like anything further to drink, we'll be happy to do that for you.
Very well done.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now I have to call my home for somebody to come.
Okay. Do you know the number?
392-1242. 392-1242. Fastest phone in Lancaster.
392-14.
Wait. 392-1242.
Okay. We're done.
Tell Laurie.